You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
7 minutes after 10, violence. Violence, unfortunately, doesn't go out of fashion. And the word violence, the term violence, is increasingly being used. I think, I don't know if I'm wrong, I mean, that itself is up for grabs. But I think the term itself has gained even greater popularity in discourse the world over in the last 2 or 3 years than has previously been the case. And one person who thinks very long and hard about violence is Rhodes University Associate Professor Richard Pithouse, who's also at the moment has a desk space and doing some research at Wits University at Wiser. But his main title, of course, is a Senior Researcher, Program Coordinator and Supervisor, the Unit for Humanities at Rhodes University, also an author of the excellent book that in many ways centers some of these questions, Writing the Decline. What? You haven't read it? Shame on you. Go get a copy and demand at the bookstore that you go to normally, order you a copy and get a copy of it. But the range of questions I want to ask this hour is, what is violence? Has the term become too broad, too elastic? Does it get used too often as a kind of trump? Or is it appropriate politically and morally that we expand what we mean by violence rather than restricting it, as some of us want to do, to physical forms of violence? And then along the way, we're going to talk about Fanon. What does he say? What does he not say about violence, etc.? So I want you to be part of this conversation. Richard is a beautiful mind. You can engage him throughout. Give us a call. The phone lines are open in Johannesburg. Call us on 011-883-0702 and in Cape Town on 021-446-0567. Richard, thank you so much for coming into the studio out of your sick bed, hopefully not infectious.
It's a pleasure, Eusebius, and as always, you're far too kind.
Richard, I want to start with the term violence. And of course, as a philosophy student, and you yourself have a philosophy background, I have a fascination here with what the term refers to. Some people, I think conveniently so, argue that everything is violent these days. You know, Richard says something bad, and I say, Richard, you're violent. Or men raise their voices, and then some feminist type or her ally will say, men are all violent, men are trash and what have you. What is violence?
Well, I mean, as you know very well, having studied philosophy yourself, you know, questions of definition are often acutely contested, and in many cases there isn't a single answer. You know, often different definitions illuminate and occlude different things. So clearly there is something to be lost by describing everything as violence. You know, if everything is violence, then nothing is violence. And that can serve to mask forms of behavior that are actually very dangerous to people. But at the same time, when we have a very narrow conception of violence and we focus our sort of hostility to certain kinds of conduct on that, it can mask forms of social organization, forms of discourse that are normalized and that are rendered, well, their consequences anyway, are kind of rendered invisible. So I don't think there's a simple answer to your question. I think that, you know, there is something to be lost by having a conception of violence that's too elastic. And plainly, as you intimated in your introductory remarks, it sometimes gets simply ridiculous. But there can be some value, and there often has been value, in looking, for instance, at how social structures are oppressive in ways that have real material consequences on, you know, even on people's bodies, as the ordinary definition of violence would.
Okay, so let's take an example, right? Because I think the uncontroversial examples of violence would be if I give you a fat clap in your face, right? That's physical. And we no contestation. Everyone agrees. Left, right, centrist, whoever you are, non-aligned, do you all agree that's violence?
Sure.
Where the term becomes contested is when you can't visibly see physical violence. So, for example, we talk about universities, and many students feel like universities are violent institutions. When I say a sentence such as, the university currently known as Rhodes is violent towards black people, does that kind of sentence make sense to you, and is it accurate?
Well, I mean, as you said, also in your introductory remarks, I mean, that comes out of a global discourse that's very fashionable. And when discourses become fashionable, sometimes it can be for a good reason. It can speak to something that was not yet named, and so it can be valuable. But when a discourse becomes, you know, too fashionable, it often becomes a substitute for thinking. It often becomes, you know, a way of sounding hip. without actually doing the labor of really engaging with what actually is going on.
Mm.
So, again, I think you might think I'm sort of hedging my bets here. I think a statement like that could, in fact, at times be inane and unhelpful, but it could also, at times, in certain persons' hands, speak to a real experience of suffering in an institution that in certain respects is not able to recognize the humanity of everybody.
Hmm.
So I think we must be careful, but certainly, you know, violence as physical force directed against the human body, that's uncontroversial. Everything else is essentially a kind of metaphor.
Mm.
And I think we need to be clear that there's a difference between a literal use of a term and a metaphorical use of a term. And metaphor is something that it's kind of slippery because, you know, a new metaphor can be really powerful. But then it can collapse into cliche, and it can be deadening to our language, to our understanding.
Mm.
But I think if we make that distinction between a literal use of the term and a metaphorical use of the term, that can help us to.
I want to stay just a little bit more with this definitional point, because I think substantive political issues are at stake in the definition. Mm-hmm. It's not just a case of philosophical hygiene. I mean, I had two beautiful persons on the show last week, in Melanie Judge, as well as the lawyer for SISA in the John Twelani case.
Mm-hmm.
And they were making the case that a column that is homophobic constitutes a form of psychological violence that gay people experience. When he compared my lifestyle to bestiality, mm-hmm. that is psychological violence. And at one point, I pressed the lawyer and I said, are you perhaps misspeaking? Are you saying that certain speech acts can make the atmosphere conducive to physical violence? And she was very clear. She said, no, and we have experts, and I followed the case since then. They've had great expert, Juanel is a psychologist, mm-hmm. testified in the case. They distinguish between real physical violence, what you, I think, mean by literal use mm-hmm. of the term, mm-hmm. and then other forms of violence that are violence on their own terms. Psychological violence doesn't leave a scar, and yet reading that particular column in the Sunday Sun or wherever it appeared in 2008, when I read that as a gay person, I experience psychological violence. Does the use of violence in that context make sense to you?
Well, I think obviously we have to be very clear that, you know, his position.
Let me just add one more thing quickly, okay. Richard, while I'm asking the question. Because although the distinction between what is literal and what's metaphorical is useful, we should also be clear that some activists, and we can debate whether they're right, some activists wouldn't want you to say that they're merely being metaphorical, because that also dilutes the very real sense of institutional violence and psychological violence. And then we have a hierarchy of violences.
Yes, I mean, I can see the logic of that argument, but I think that it's a question of precision. I mean, you see, what's going on in your question and in the discussion you referenced just now is a kind of implicit assumption that we can only really say that something is seriously unjust, that it's seriously outrageous, and that it seriously needs to be opposed if it's violence.
That's true.
So it somehow kind of centers violence as the fundamental measure. And I'm not sure if we always need to do that. I think there might be other measures, there might be other ways. And I think we need to ask why it is at this point, and I don't have an answer to this, but at this point in the last few years, globally, there's suddenly a sense that violence is the measure. So we want to say everything is violence in order to say it's bad.
Yeah.
Perhaps
that's a very good point.
We need to wonder why that is the case. Because it wasn't like that. It wasn't like that at all points in history. You know, I mean, often the work of politics is the work of giving the right names to things. You know, maybe we need a more diverse vocabulary sometimes. Because certainly to say that, you know, we're using the term metaphorically here doesn't mean that that we're offering an alibi for another form of oppression.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, sometimes systems that are not violent can be far more damaging to people than certain kinds of violence.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Okay, let's take our first caller. We've got Nina on the line. Just put on your headphones for me, Richard, and then we will go to Craig Hall. One of my favorite peoples in the world of talk radio is Citizen Nina. How's it, Nina?
Okay, how are you, Phoebus?
I'm very well, thanks.
I want a cup of tea with you to show you some books I've got that I think you'll be interested in, so we must somehow make it happen.
Consider it done.
Yay!
We'll do it, definitely.
That's very exciting. Very exciting.
What do you want to say about violence? Do you think the term has become too elastic?
I don't mind elasticity because I think our brains are elastic. And for instance, our brains don't seem to have minded calling cars by innumerable names or toothpaste by innumerable names. And I have heard that in, for instance, Japan, there are innumerable names for love. The thing is to actually become more exquisite about defining the differences of violence.
Hmm.
So in other words, I don't think it's particularly difficult for humans to understand that violence can be a clap. Violence can be an instituted economic system which precludes certain people, or a political system which calls some people whites and some non-whites. So that we can understand that kind of violence. And perhaps if we want to address adjectives to make them more clear, we can say this is this kind and this is that kind.
Mm.
And what they all fall under is hurting the other, either physically or in terms of their sense of identity. I think what's going on in the States now in terms of the trans toilet debacle obviously is also an insane violence. So I think that sometimes there are terms that do trigger a high emotive response, like violence, and we shouldn't lose that by making subtler, descriptors. But I think we simply ought to say that there is a cartography or a lexicon,
yes,
of different violences.
And I think that's right, yeah. I think that's right. You know, Richard raises a very important question. Why is it that we're obsessed with the term violence? Why has that become the gold standard of wrong that deserves urgent social attention? But, you know, and I, that's a question I'm going to ruminate on for a while, Nina, but my stab of an answer to Richard, and I wonder what yours is that some people, and they are invariably the beneficiaries of violence, also like it when we exclude things from the list of things that can be named violence, because then they don't have to feel guilty about inaction or helping to perpetuate violence. So if I think about people who write the world over, churn out 2,000-word essays trying to restrict the use of the word violence, I think to myself in turn, why are you so eager? You know what I mean?
No, I do know what you mean, because the point is, it is pointing to a very, disturbing and horrible part of human identity, which is to undermine the other in order to acquire your own power.
Hmm.
So that is actually a very unvenerable process. And that's why we use terms like this. I think if one were referring to the Bible, the kind of 10 terms which we know can be used with very high power in terms of what the brain does and what we've accrued over centuries as understanding is problematic. And I believe you have to sustain the heat around a term which is actually talking about abominations, because obviously violence at its worst means war.
Absolutely. Nina, we're going to leave it there. We're going to take more calls after the break. What do you understand by violence? Do you think the term is used too liberally these days? And if so, why do you think that is? Why is it only when we use the term that we might actually successfully draw attention to a phenomenon that should be accepted as wrong with different vocabulary, which is the question that Richard has asked? 011-883-0702. Have your say in Johannesburg and in Cape Town on 021-446-0567. Richard, I know you can give an entire lecture series on the next question, so good luck in trying to give us the radio version.
Okay.
What did Fanon say about violence?
Well, I mean, when we make sense of Fanon in English at the moment, although this is about to change with the publication of a whole lot of new work, we do so on the basis of three books written in the space of 10 years. The first book is about Fanon's experiences in Martinique and as a black student in France and Lyon. And that book is about the lived experience of anti-black racism. It is not fundamentally about violence, certainly not in the way Fanon uses the term. Of course, in the way the term is now used, perhaps people would say it is.
Hmm.
His second book is written, that book comes out in 52. His second book comes out in 59, and that's written during the war against colonialism in Algeria. Fanon wrote it in Tunisia. That book is not really about violence. That book has five chapters, and I'm trying to be brief as I can here, each of which illuminates a moment or a kind of space in which, in the vortex of struggle, through the lived experience of struggle, people's ideas about themselves and their place in the world and their relation to the world change. It's about ordinary people in struggle, and it's about struggle as a site of learning. Fanon calls it mutation. But he's very concerned with how colonialism introduces a kind of Manichaeanism, a kind of split at the ideological level between good and evil, beautiful and ugly, black and white, settler and colonized, into the colonial space. And he's looking at how in the initial moments of struggle that is repeated in struggle, but how it breaks down through experience. That book isn't about violence. His last book, written in Tunis, also when he was dying in 1961, is the book where he talks about violence. And very often his entire body of thought is reduced to a few pages in the first chapter of that book. Although more often, I would say...
Which book is that?
The Wretched of the Earth. Mm-hmm. It's often been read through Jean-Paul Sartre's introduction, which the best available evidence we have strongly suggests that Fanon didn't like that introduction very much himself. In that book, Fanon looks at a number of things. He looks at how that kind of Manichaean ideology of racism is concretized in the material structure of the city and the settler colony. So there's part of the city that is light because it has electricity. There's part that's dark because it doesn't. How race is spatialized and space is racialized. Mm. He looks at how when struggle against colonialism begins, it inverts and repeats the Manichaeanism imposed by colonialism. So, you know, the project is simply to remove the settler, basically. And that's where he talks about violence. He then goes on in the book to problematize that initial Manichaeanism, what he calls immediate knowledge. He says, in fact, there's a weary road to rational knowledge. And he says things are much more complicated than that. And he looks again at how in struggle that Manichaeanism can break down. And he warns that if that doesn't happen, you will have a new post-colonial system that will replicate many features of the colonial system, that will have its own vectors of injustice. And he then looks at struggle against the sort of oppressive post-colonial system. And the last part of the book are some of his case notes that he took in Algeria when he ran a psychiatric hospital. And they're about the tremendous damage that violence does to people. So there's no doubt that Fanon endorsed violence in certain circumstances. I mean, he was a soldier in the Free French Forces fighting against the fascists, against the Nazis in North Africa and in Southern Europe. And of course, he joined a violent struggle against colonialism in Algeria. In 1959, when he spoke at a meeting of liberation movements from across the continent, he spoke very strongly for violent opposition to colonialism. But there's also no doubt that he did not argue, as he sometimes misunderstood to have done, for some kind of crude Manichaean response to the Manichaeanism introduced by colonialism. In fact, he thought it was absolutely vital to problematize that. Also, I mean, and I'm sorry I'm taking a little bit longer, but I'll conclude with this point. Within the FLN, the Algerian National Liberation Movement, there was a real contestation between the militarists who wanted to push, you know, violence as a strategy to the forefront and allow that to dominate the movement, and people who had a much more democratic vision and wanted the use of violence to be under democratic control. Fanon was clearly in the second camp. His closest comrade in the movement is a guy called Abane Ramdani, who was in fact murdered by the militarists in the FLN. And Fanon was acutely aware of the dangers of allowing the militarists to take over that struggle. Hmm. And in that respect, he was right, because, you know, Algeria won its liberation through an incredibly violent war. I mean, there's disagreements on how many lives it cost, but, you know, the figure was huge. Many people say more than a million. What happened after that was not the development of a just and democratic society. Algeria, in fact, is still, to this day, an oppressive society. So Fanon certainly doesn't reduce the political to violence, as many people think that he does. He's acutely aware of the limits of that position and how it can set up new forms of domination. That's okay. A very brief answer. There's a lot more to say.
But great. We'll unpack it some more. That's why we've got you alone for an entire hour.
Your CBS Makaiser on 702 and Cape Talk.
Richard, let's take another call. We've got Arnold on the line. Thank you for your patience, Arnold. Go ahead.
Hi, you CBS. Do you remember when you were at the other station before you came to
Yes, before I came home.
Yeah, and I used to really listen to you. And I was so upset when you actually left them. But anyway, do you remember you mentioning about a certain politician taking all his interest in London and putting into a trust, and therefore he had no more interest in London? Now, isn't that amazing? A cunning linguist like you, trust. And this brings me on to hello?
Ach, no, man. That line is not very clear, Arnold. I want to hear what you have to say about psychological trauma. I'm going to ask my producer to see whether we can get you back there. I think you wanted to go back to the psychological elements of violence. We'll see whether we can get you back. In fact, let's do so immediately. Go ahead, Arnold. What do you want to say?
So you want to talk about psychological violence?
Yes. What is on your mind? Just go ahead.
Yeah. I talk about sticks and stones will break my bones, but words will never hurt me. Whereas it was quite fascinating. I was actually listening to an opposing radio station, and this person was talking about which is worse, physical violence, stealing from a person, or embarrassing somebody in public. Which one do you think is the worst?
I think the question is not very helpful because we are irreducibly complex. We have psychological needs. We have physical integrity that matters to our person. And I wouldn't want to play that game of a Olympics of violent suffering.
The thing is, what was fascinating here was I heard your previous, I think it was your guest saying something about a hierarchy of violence. And interesting, this person was actually a rabbi, and he was actually saying that, you know, when you embarrass somebody in public, which incidentally is the worst of the three, believe it or not, and I only found out, I mean, I'm 58 years old, and if I only found out a year ago, in other words, I'm 57,
yes,
that this is true, and I think this is quite true, because he was actually saying, actually, I think in the Tory, and I know that you're actually an atheist, but please forgive me, but you're saying that actually, the person will actually go white in the face and then red. And you're saying that is actually shows that it's actually worse than bloodletting. So embarrassing a person in public is really, really not good.
Yeah, I don't, you know, I think there are situations, Richard, where we can't escape questions of whether some forms of oppression or wrongdoing are relatively worse than others. I mean, the bottom line is that my life, my positionality as a middle-class butch gay man is far more psychologically and otherwise secure than a working-class lesbian woman living in a South African township. So I'm not against gradations, but there is a danger there, isn't there, of a very callous game that we begin to play.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, clearly we do have to take very, very seriously that different people occupy different spaces in systems of oppression, and oppression is not something that people experience the same. But, I mean, I think the problem with your guest's proposal is that it's totally without context. I mean, we don't know who the person is. Psychological humiliation can be very damaging to a person, but it's all about the context in that particular case.
Absolutely.
So I wouldn't want to make a kind of abstract hierarchy. I mean, you know, different people experience things differently for different reasons, some to do with their identities, some to do with what happened to them as children, for instance. You know?
Okay. I've got a couple of Fanon 101 questions for you, and then it will nicely bring us to the South African state. On Fanon, so I see some people just dropping Fanon's name and basically saying, Fanon said it's okay for me to use violence. I experience violence, therefore any violence in my strategies and tactics are morally justified. Is that just simplistic and maybe even a wrong reading of Fanon?
I think that can often be very simplistic, and at times it can be a reading that you can't sustain by a serious reading of the text. I mean, we have to remember that Fanon was writing in the middle of an extraordinarily brutal and violent colonial war. It's a situation in which there was no other mechanism that could be used. You were dealing with a military occupation. There was no possibility for the performance of non-violence, that kind of political theater. To take that and generalize it, across space and time, as if Fanon is giving us a universal moral injunction, I don't think makes much sense. And of course, as I was saying earlier, Fanon was acutely aware of the damage that violence does to people. He ended his last book with that. He was also, as I said already as well, acutely aware of the damage that can be done to a struggle when it becomes militarized. There's a reason why he gave us all these case studies of the kind of learning, the kind of change, what he called the mutation, that can happen in struggle. He certainly didn't reduce struggle to violence. I mean, in fact, in his schema, that is the initial response to colonialism, one that has to be transcended, not in the sense that one has to abandon violence at some point. I mean, in the Algerian War, you only stopped violence when you won the war, but in the sense that you had to think way beyond that. You had to think in a much more sophisticated way. And in fact, he's a very democratic thinker. So we also have to think in a much more democratic way, because violence often, not always, when it enters the political terrain, does so as a kind of substitutionism. A small group of people will act for everyone else.
Mm.
And that's something that certainly Fanon is extremely critical of. You know,
which brings me exactly to my next sort of Fanon 101 question. Did he have much to say? The other phrase that obviously has become quite popular, especially amongst fallers and young people, is a struggle must be intersectional, justice must be intersectional, or it's not there at all. And then sometimes you find some of the same comrades also being the ones who are very uncritical in their theorizing about violence. But one thing that you've often pointed out to me in the privilege of our friendship conversations about violence is how when violence happens, when violence takes place, violence is not neutral. Ironically enough, violence can, for example, be chauvinistic. It can reproduce all sorts of nasty things, which the very people who say they're committed to intersectional justice probably wouldn't want to sign up for us. Unpack for us how that plays out.
Look, I think that's a really important point. I mean, of course, women have often been soldiers, you know, in Eritrea or right now in the Kurdish struggle. But that doesn't mean that violence is not something that is not very frequently gendered. When a struggle moves onto the terrain of violence, it often becomes a masculinized space. And we've seen that again and again. When women are able to enter that terrain, they're often sent home as soon as it's over. So I think we have to be very cautious about how that kind of language and that kind of posture can often become complicit with a masculinist posture. We also have to be critical with how it can be complicit in a shift away from kind of open democratic forms of politics to forms of politics that are much more authoritarian. You know, I mean, when a struggle gets onto a violent terrain, there are obviously real limits about, you know, the possibilities for democratic practices. That's just not something that is easy to do under those circumstances. So I think we do have to be very well aware of those things. And also, you know, our society is structured in such a way, globally and here, that when violence is authorized, when it's legitimated, when it's normalized, there are certain people who are much, much more at risk of being subject to violence. I'm talking now about actual physical violence, literal violence, as we mentioned earlier, than other people. And we need to be acutely aware of that. You know, if a contestation, say, on a campus becomes violent, working class African people are very much at risk of being subject to violence from, say, the state, much more so and then say middle-class people generally, or especially middle-class white people, you know, there's much more likely to be violence, you know, serious violence from the state at a historically black working-class mm-hmm. university, for instance, than there would be at say, UCT. So I don't think we should... You know, people do sometimes speak about violence like it's this kind of magical thing, this redemptive thing, this kind of elixir. It isn't. It's something that sometimes cannot be avoided. There are circumstances in which to not face up to the responsibility to confront forms of oppression directly in a material way would be to be complicit with them, would be unwise. But violence doesn't guarantee anything. I mean, absolutely. Algeria, Vietnam, Mozambique, these were all societies liberated from colonialism by violence. None of them are what we would consider to be just or democratic societies now. And very often, when things go in that direction, the people who are most at risk are the people who are, in fact, most oppressed.
Absolutely.
So it requires really careful thought and not quick sloganeering. I mean, that's often not helpful.
Okay. On the other side of this break, I want us to talk about the South African state, its use of violence, continuities with the apartheid government, as horrible as those comparisons often are for many of us who know the differences between the two states, and then civil society and how it responds. Before we take the break, however, Richard, just a bit of a name dump from you. Everyone goes to Fanon. Are there other scholars that are important, that if someone is really serious about wanting to understand violence, read what someone had written about it, besides Fanon, what names would give you pleasure as a scholar to see gaining in greater popular currency than just Fanon and Biko left, right, and center in these conversations publicly?
Well, I mean, I think Fanon does have a tremendous amount to offer us, and I think it's great that so many young people especially are reading Fanon. I mean, the first text that I would recommend, I mean, it deals with the question of violence, but it doesn't center it. Is a brilliant book written by a Ghanaian intellectual called Ato Setchiotu, published in 1996, called Fanon and the Dialectic of Experience. I think it's the most impressive attempt to read Fanon from A, an African perspective, rather than from the metropolitan perspective, but B, also from an awareness, which is absolutely present in Fanon's own work, that the colonial problem is not the only problem we have to think seriously about. We also have to think seriously about the nature of our societies after colonialism,
absolutely.
To think seriously about the post-colonial crisis. And Ato Setchiotu does that brilliantly. And I think he reads Fanon with, you know, tremendous attention to the nuances of Fanon's texts, and really opens up a reading that is democratic, but also one that enables us to avoid this kind of collapse into simple posturing and sloganeering. I mean, you know, there's all kinds of other texts on the question of violence. I'm not sure that there's one that speaks clearly to the particular conjuncture we find ourselves in right now and the way in which violence is mobilized now. But there's certainly a lot of good books that have thought very carefully about the relation between violence and the political, and whether militarist forms of politics should dominate struggles, or whether they should be subordinated to some kind of democratic project. I mean, one really interesting book that's quite recent, though, is called "This Nonviolent Stuff Will Get You Killed." It's about the civil rights struggle in America, which is often held up as an instance of nonviolent struggle. And it shows that, you know, while many of their actions were, many of the key figures in that struggle were armed or were surrounded by people who were armed.
That's a very cool title. Is the book itself very good?
Yeah, it's absolutely worth reading, because I think, you know, as you said at the beginning of your...
By Charles E. Cobb Jr.
That's
right.
You know, your introductory remarks... There's tremendous political contestation over what counts as violence, what doesn't, what kind of violence is simply ignored or normalized, what kind of violence is given attention. And, you know, the civil rights struggle is often misused to make certain kinds of arguments about forms or against forms of politics that confront oppression directly. And I think that this is a really useful historicization of it. And it shows that... many people in that struggle were armed and had to be in order to create the space for that democratic participatory politics.
Okay, let's take a quick break there. The title of that book, I've just pulled it up here with an image. I don't know which version you've seen. This cover is amazing. An old Tunny sitting there with her rifle. Wow. This nonviolent stuff will get you killed. How guns made the civil rights movement possible. And that is a book by Charles E. Cobb Jr. On the other side of this break, we're going to have a look at the South African state and the ways in which violence is being used sometimes during democratic times. We're still in conversation with Associate Professor Richard Pithouse about violence. Richard, we've got about 8 minutes left or so, which brings us nicely to the year and now. You keep mentioning how one of the insights from Fanon, properly read, is that colonialism and settlers were not and are not our only problem. And that's fascinating because one distinction that I didn't really grasp until recently, to be honest, is the difference between post-colonial states and neo-colonial states. Is the suggestion, plainly put, that liberation heroes, including ANC liberators, can get into power and then wittingly or unwittingly reproduce the very behavior they were opposing?
Well, I mean, clearly Fanon argues that, you know, in The Wretched of the Earth, there's a whole section there where he's looking at the limits of nationalism as a political ideology, and he argues again and again that we see similar forms of domination reappear or be sustained into the period after colonialism. And in fact, we see them legitimated by, ironically, by a kind of anti-colonial rhetoric, which wants us to remain stuck within that Manichaeanism. So we have a simple choice between, you know, are we for colonialism or are we for anti-colonialism? And once we accept that, it becomes impossible to be properly critical of the post-colonial regimes.
So in your understanding of this language, are we living in a society that is properly to be thought of as a post-colonial South African state or neo-colonial one?
We've always had dimensions of our society since 1994 that are neo-colonial.
What are examples of those?
Well, I mean, you spoke about violence at Rhodes University. I mean, there's no question that there are, you know, parts of the university that have never thought about their location in the colonial history and that continue to reproduce ideas that come straight from that history, a very, very violent history. I mean, you know, that university, the actual buildings began their lives as a fort on the frontier of the Cape Colony, and they were used, you know, I mean, it was part of a massacre. So, you know, that would be one instance of a neo-colonial feature in the post-apartheid era. But the way in which some people are governed, and in particular impoverished black people, also shows clear continuities. You know, some of us, you know, I mean, like myself, are governed by an administration and a bureaucracy. Others are governed with the straight-up use of violence. You know, if you, for instance, live in a shack and the land invasions unit comes to evict you, they will do so by destroying your home. They will come with men with guns. If you resist, you will be subject to violence. Even if you don't resist, you may well be subject to violence. It'll be an indiscriminate use of violence. And images from, say, 2017 or 2010 or look very much like images from 1959 in Cato Manor or the 1980s in Crossroads in Cape Town. Those practices by the state have not changed. They still treat some people as if they are outside of the democratic order.
How does it make you feel, both as a scholar but also as a citizen of this country? I always used to expend enormous energy, including on various talk show platforms, resisting comparisons between the apartheid state and our democratic state, because apartheid was thoroughly wicked, and I mean wicked in a normative moral sense. And yet the reality is that even when we want to shut up the most right-wing people who hate democracy, these continuities have got to be pointed out. But I find it deeply, deeply sad that that is a description that is empirically accurate.
Well, those continuities are there, and that they are empirical facts that have to be addressed. I mean, one possible answer to the problem that you're posing is to ask why it is that we always want to reduce evil to apartheid. I mean, it maybe takes us back to the beginning of the conversation. Because clearly apartheid is a social evil. And it's very easy when there's continuities to say, look, this is the same. Hmm. The state's conducting itself in the same way. But, you know, I think perhaps we need to think beyond that frame sometimes, because the state also behaves like that in India. It behaves like that in Brazil. There's something about the structure of our societies more broadly that can't simply be reduced to the question of apartheid. And I think sometimes we need to understand our own society and its pathologies in a much wider international frame. I mean, you know, one of the great things that happened with the emergence of the student movement in 2015 is we no longer simply think about apartheid, you know, a period from, you know, 1948 to 1994 as a kind of problem. I mean, we've now understood clearly, which is a real progress, that apartheid was just one period, a really brief period, in a colonial history. Mm. And we've been able to situate how our society has become what it has become and how it still sustains certain features from the past in a much broader historical frame. Because we've taken colonialism seriously. I mean, I think that's a major breakthrough. But I think perhaps also we should situate it in this wider frame, because certain kinds of people are governed with violence as an ordinary, everyday process, one that is not read as problematic, that doesn't appear very often in the TV news.
Absolutely.
All over the world. And we need to ask ourselves, why is that? And, you know, it's not simply a matter of the ANC replicating the National Party. There's all kinds of other forces at play. There's all kinds of other ideas at play. You know, a much more nuanced conversation about that might help us. I mean, certainly I learn a tremendous amount from people thinking about these kinds of things in, say, Bolivia or Haiti or India. Mm. And they're thinking about it from a much broader context.
Absolutely. I'm going to drop my last question because we've run out of time, and perhaps we can have a full roundtable in the next couple of weeks and bring in some other folks, Richard. The last question that I was going to ask Richard, which is, you know, we'll save it for the next 2 weeks or so, and hopefully Richard can give us more time, is how should civil society respond to these continuities? And if you look at the internal workings of civil society organizations, are they beyond reproach? Are they morally obviously good? And then talking strategies and tactics, we can bring him in, someone like Mark Haywood, you of course, as the listeners at the center of that conversation. So that will be a second installment. But just in 30 seconds, Richard, there's a fascinating book event happening at Wits University tomorrow at 6 o'clock at Wiser. Just to tell us about that if anyone is interested and can make it.
The author is Michael Neocosmos. He's written a book called Thinking Freedom in Africa. It's won the 2017 Frantz Fanon Award, which is given by the Caribbean Philosophy Association. It's an extraordinarily wide-ranging attempt to think about freedom in Africa as a kind of insurgent political practice. It ranges from the Haitian Revolution through to the Land and Freedom Army in Kenya in the 1950s through to South Africa in the 1980s. Hmm. So it goes kind of from the late 1700s to, I think, 2014 is where it ends. It's a really ambitious
great
book,
stuff.
And it should be hopefully an interesting discussion.
Okay, I'm going to be there. It's tomorrow, Wednesday, 6 p.m. at Wiser at Wits. And Michael Neocosmos will be in conversation with both Richard and also with Achille Mbembe. Don't miss that one. Richard, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.